Soundtracks of movies become soundtracks of our culture. Movies, for some of us, are a form of modern church. So though you may not immediately recognize the name Gustavo Santaolalla, you've probably heard the cinematic landscapes he's created for films like Babel and Brokeback Mountain, for which he's won Academy Awards. This is the opening track from the film The Motorcycle Diaries. We experience Gustavo Santaolalla's human and creative philosophy behind a kind of music that moves us like no other.
I, in general, like not to have too much music in the movies. I like the music to become relevant at certain points. When you have a really dramatic scene, when something is really happening on the screen, why would you put some music to it, you know? I mean, you can turn something dramatic into something melodramatic very easily.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Gustavo Santaolalla grew up in Argentina in the time of the military junta and the trauma that became known as the Dirty War. After moving to Los Angeles, he became a record producer, a sometime solo performer, and he's composed the scores for over a dozen feature films. In all of this, he sustains a creative tension between his Argentinian identity and the global contours of modern film and modern life. So tell me, just as we begin, how would you describe the spiritual background of your childhood? You know, however you understand that now.
Absolutely. I was raised in the province of Buenos Aires. I wasn't raised in the city. I was probably an hour away from the city in a very bucolic place. I mean, you know, dirt roads and birds and insects and gardens and wonderful trees. My parents were Catholic. I mean, my mom's still Catholic. My dad passed away when I was young. And I was raised Catholic. And so I always find a connection between music and kind of that spiritual life that came to me basically through, you know, me going to church and what I was learning there. I started playing guitar when I was 5 years old. So it was a very early age. And, you know, I could really connect the music and that art, you know, to my spirit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was an altar boy. I mean, I did, you know, all the things. And I was very interested in the church, actually. I thought of becoming a priest when I was a little kid. But by the time I was 11, I went into a spiritual crisis.
That's young for a spiritual crisis. You were a prodigy in your spiritual crisis.
Well, and so I went to the priest and told him my questions. And they called my parents and they even planned to exorcise me or something. And my father, who was an amazing guy, just told me, you know, listen, if you don't feel it anymore, you shouldn't do it, you know. And that was it. I was never called upon that subject anymore by my parents. And they just let me continue with my own search, which I still do until this day. And then I went into, you know, different searches in my life. I actually lived in a commune between 18 and 24, and I led a pretty monastic life. I mean, we're talking about years, you know, where we're, you know, the hippie years and, you know, other type of also of communes, but, you know,
Seen that described as a yogic commune that you were in.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Yes. And we did, you know, comparative studies of religion. And,
really?
And it was a great, yeah.
And
it
you
was
were a
great,
band, right? But you were.
We were in a big band, yeah. A band that was, you know,
and
for
I've
a while.
And I've seen like a fusion of rock and Latin American folk.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Arcoiris was the name of the band, Rainbow. Right. And I led a truly monastic life. I didn't do any drugs or alcohol. I didn't eat any meat. I mean, I was vegetarian in Argentina at a time where people looked at you like, is this guy okay? Is he sick? I mean, how can he not eat meat? But also I was celibate, you know, I mean, all
really?
Those years, you know. Yes, uh-huh. Yes. I mean, in the pinnacle of success with my rock band, I practiced Kundalini yoga and, you know, so transmute my energy. And it was a great learning experience, and lots of stuff that I learned there, it took with me for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Let me just ask you about, so that was your first band when you were 16, but I've seen two interesting musical influences from your early life. And one of them is tango, that you just, that you grew up listening to tango just around the house. And the other was the Beatles.
Of course. Well, the Beatles are like my I think, you know, I mean, I was listening to music before the Beatles came.
Yeah.
You know, and to our light, really they made the difference, and they were a guiding force, and, you know, still are. I mean, I believe they're kind of like my musical parents, you know. Tango, I you know, it was music that was around the house, and it was around everywhere, because you can hear tango on the buses or, you know, on the radio at home. My father used to sing every morning. Meanwhile, he shaved, he would sing, you know, tangos, and he would stop the shaving to, you know, finish a phrase of a tango. So it was around me and part of my sort of my sonic landscape since I was a kid. At the beginning, really, I mean, I didn't get it when I was a kid. But when I became more involved and I had my band, I always had tremendous respect for the musicians and for the genre. I mean, the genre is such an unbelievable style of music. I mean, it's a style of music that can be so sophisticated and yet so popular. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know,
both of those things at the same time. Yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah.
And so I always was very, very respectful about it. And because I am a sort of an advocate of the concept of identity, and I always felt that it was very important for me to show who I am and where do I come from in everything that I do. I knew that at a certain point, tango was going to come into my life. I just, you know, had to wait. And I think in my case, although there are some great young tango performers and artists involved with the culture, in my case, I mean, I think age play an important role. I think...
What do you mean by
tango,
that?
Well, I think tango taps into subjects in such a passionate and with such a experienced in life that you have to really have lived some time to really appreciate it. You know, I always find very, almost I would say ridiculous, you know, when you see a little kid on TV singing a tango, I just think that
they can't get it, that they can't possibly understand it?
No, because I think, you know, you need to have some true, you know, heavy experiences. I mean, you have to have experienced life to be able to interpret properly that genre.
Vieja viola, garufera y vibradora de mis tiempos de parranda y copetín, de las tantas serenatas a la lora, que la dueña de mi cuore y patrona del bulín. ¿Cómo estás de abandonada y silenciosa después que fuiste mi sueño de canto? ¿Quién te ha oído sonar, papa y melodiosa? No dice que sos la dueña de mi pobre corazón. Es que la gola se...
So in my case, it really worked that way. You know, that's when I decided to explore in the genre. And since I'm not an academically trained musician, I don't know how to read or write music, but my way really to learn is by doing it, you know, playing it or listening to it or being close to somebody that is a master, so I can learn something from that way. And so I did a project called Café de los Maestros that involved, I think, the greatest tango players alive at the moment. Unfortunately, that project, you know, came out in 2005, and most of the people that participated on that are now gone. And so it was great to actually capture them, still vital, still, you know, doing great music. And it was a very, very rewarding experience.
Mm-hmm.
This music is from that Café de los Maestros album featuring legendary masters of tango from the 1940s and 50s. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. My guest, Gustavo Santaolalla, is best known in the U.S. for his Oscar-winning soundtracks to movies like Babel and Brokeback Mountain. I think what you just said about tango, that it holds depths of human experience. One thing that people experience in your music, and probably most people have experienced that through the music you've written for movies, Brokeback Mountain or Babel or Motorcycle Diaries, is this scope of human experience, laughter and joy and pain and heartbreak and loss, that all those things are there together. And I do want to ask you if you think that that was also informed by growing up in Argentina when you did. I mean, you talked about identity as this theme that runs throughout your life and your spiritual search and your music. And I just wonder if you'd say a little bit more about that root of your own identity.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a combination of many things. I mean, as I grew older and did more, I mean, lots of times I've been able to articulate things years after I've, I played them. For example, I mean, now I can talk about my use of silence and space in the music, but it was totally something that was, I mean, unconscious in the sense. I mean, that was the way I heard that it should be played, you know, not that it was something that I was doing on purpose, that there was, you know, a logistic behind that decision. It was very intuitive, just like everything that I do.
Something you wrote or where you observed the silence or space later on? A piece
I
of
think
music.
Brokeback Mountain is a great example, you know? Like in some of those, the first theme that plays when the movie opens. Dun. Dun, dun. And so there's all those spaces, you know. I mean, I love that moment where you're kind of suspended and you're, you know, it's not the silence that occurs at the very end of a tune, but it's a silence that occurs between two notes. I like to think that, you know, playing a lot of notes is something that is easier to achieve. You just practice a lot and you get to play a lot of notes. Not playing, it's a little bit more difficult sometimes, you know. Going back to the subject of identity, I feel that there's a point that even all those influences, I mean, obviously they come to play a role, but then there's something more deep that really relates to who you are as a human being. And obviously that all those elements, those cultural elements, your upbringing, all that plays a role, but there is something that comes from within and that connects to something that I don't understand, and any artist that is really honest, I think, will agree that there's a point that you don't really know who is doing what you're doing. I mean, you are doing it, but there's something, there's a connection with something else that is beyond your understanding. And finding who you are in that connection, that's another deeper part of your identity that I'm working on now, you know?
That's really interesting. And it's also something that's really hard to talk about, right? To put words around.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because I hear you're talking about something relational, and like whether you want to call that God or...
Yes, I don't like, I mean, for many years, you know, I mean, I'm kind of like an agnostic now, you know, and I do feel that there is something that is bigger and stronger than me, than each one of these elements that we are, you know, part of, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that somehow that's in the creative process, that you experience that through the creative process.
I believe so. Mm-hmm. I believe so. It's something that is really beyond me. And I think because of the connection with heart, with the feelings, you know, it's not something that is just neurological. But I feel that whatever I do, it has to be connected with the heart. As much as rational as I can put into something and say, I'm going to use this instrument, or for this movie, I believe this. And that is part of, rationalizing what I'm going to do. The moment that I'm creating and that I'm there confronted with whatever comes out of my hands or whatever I'm, playing, it's something really that connects with my heart.
There's also, there's very much in your musical career this transcending boundaries of identity. I mean, certainly, geographic and cultural, right? And again, it's all through your musical career. It's certainly there. I mean, in the scores you've done for movies, Brokeback Mountain could not be more American. Babel had this Middle Eastern component. Motorcycle Diaries, Latin America. It seems like that is a special part of your kind of inspiration. How does that fit into kind of your, I would say your philosophy of music or what music can do?
Well, I do believe that part of, you have an identity, a first identity that is related probably to your family.
Yeah.
Then you have an identity with your block, the block that you live in, then your neighborhood, then the city, then the country, then the region of the world. And then finally the world. There is an identity of us as planetary beings. And specifically also, in those examples, Brokeback Mountain and Babel and Motorcycle Diaries, I did want to, also obviously express in the music, the backdrop that this music was set up against. But at the same time, I wanted to give it a universal feeling. I think in Brokeback Mountain, for example, I know that there is an influences of Atahualpa Yupanqui, who was an amazing guitar player and singer-songwriter from Argentina. Probably nobody knows this, but I know that there is an influence. And I'm pretty sure if somebody from Texas would have done the music, it would have been different, And yet, it fit. The music, it did fit. And nobody said, this sounds like, this doesn't sound like a music that could be in an Americana movie. It fits, but yet it was, it has that, for me, that global component that I also like to feel that I have in my, that sort of universal feeling to it, no matter if it's tinted with, South American flavor or with an Americana flavor or a Middle Eastern flavor, still has a universal appeal.
You talked a minute ago about the different layers of identity that pertain to all of us, from the very personal to the global. Mm-hmm. I think, though, even though in the 21st century we live in a globalized world where our fate is tied in very concrete ways to people across the globe, that heart connection to that reality is not always easy to muster, right? We haven't all made that leap in our minds and hearts.
I'm sorry, you said our fate is connected?
Yeah, that our fate. I mean, we genuinely are tied to the fate of people around the world.
Absolutely. Right? We are all connected.
But we don't always, it can also be an abstraction. And it seems to me that through music you actually have access to that, to those
music
overlapping
identities
in a way that...
I agree with you because I think music is a different art form. I mean, I've been told this by some of these great directors that I had the opportunity to work with. I mean, and not just one of them, but, you know, three of them, you know, the great ones, Alejandro González Iñárritu, Walter Salles, and Ang Lee. I mean, they manifested how sometimes, you know, they feel envy about a musician because, you know, for their art, there's so many steps involved in the process of making a film, you know, getting the camera and shooting a scene and editing and looking at it and act. I mean, whereas, you know, you grab a guitar and you can just create a moment and then it goes. Boom, that's it. You know, if you play something live, you will play it in and it went. Where did it go? You know, but it could evoke in that moment all kinds of emotions. I think music has that. It's embedded in the DNA of music, this universal connection. It is part of what music has that I don't think all arts have.
Right. You know, you've told a story about when you were doing the score for Babel, and you said you were looking for an instrument that worked as a connector.
Correct.
And you didn't want it to end up sounding like it was a National Geographic documentary.
Correct.
Right? I mean, tell that story, because I think that's a great example, though, of also how you're not doing this in a linear, simplistic
yes,
way.
Yes, because I you know, an instrument can be a great storyteller. And I thought about it for Babel specifically because, you know, the film takes place in three different locations, in Africa, in Southern California, Mexico, Mexican border, and in Japan. So I found in the oud that instrument, and the oud is the ancestor of the lute, therefore the ancestor of the guitar, something very related to me personally. So the oud was perfect for this Arabic feel that I wanted to have in the Moroccan part of the film. But although I don't play the oud like a traditional oud player, because they play with a plectrum, I play with my fingers, it's a totally different groove. I just, you know, but it still is the instrument. I didn't want it to sound, you know, 100% truly folkloric from that part. I just wanted to evoke that feeling. And that instrument, because it was an ancestor of the guitar and it connected to the guitar, for me was perfect for the Mexico, you know.
Right, it has tentacles to these other cultures then.
Of course. Uh-huh. And it had a resonance, especially when I played it the way I played it, with the koto, which is a string instrument from Japan. So I found that this instrument could connect the stories and it was a great helper for me.
There's this line, I think you've said, it's an Argentinian idea, that paint your little village and you will be painting the world.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what we've been talking about.
You can listen again and share this show with Gustavo Santaolalla through our website, onbeing.org. I'm Krista Tippett. On Being continues in a moment. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, a conversation with the Argentinian film composer and musician Gustavo Santaolalla. He often brings the ronroco, a small Andean instrument from the mandolin family, into his music and his award-winning film scores for Brokeback Mountain and Babel. This is him playing the ronroco and the guitar in his score for the animated film The Book of Life. Gustavo Santaolalla is based in Los Angeles, but he grew up making music as the dirty war began in Argentina, in which so many people disappeared at the hands of a military junta. He's remained steeped in a Latin American sensibility, even as he scores films that evoke the global contours of modern life. You know, I wanted to ask you about what you've learned about how music works with movies and in movies. mm-hmm. to deepen and, you know, complete that experience. But I'm wondering, as I'm listening to you speak, whether, you know, in fact, the music in movies is part of what draws us on an emotional level into that, like makes this experience that we're watching, the story, connects on another level to our own internal lives.
Yes, I'm going to talk from my particular experience, because there's, you know, so many ways to tap into this. And there's people, you know, that do a different type of work and still is amazing. You know, people that work with huge orchestras and with movies that have music and music and music and music. I mean, I've done some of that too. But in general, you know, my approach has been always more minimal and with a discrete use of music. I find that music in movies, I in general like not to have too much music in the movies. I like the music to become relevant at certain points. You know, when you have a really dramatic scene where something is really happening on the screen, why would you put some music to it, you know? I mean, you can turn something dramatic into something melodramatic very easily. You know, I find that also very disturbing sometimes in documentaries, you know, when you have something that is a very strong reality or very, and you put music to it, and then it kind of like trivializes.
Well, it can also be emotionally manipulative.
Exactly. And then so I always like to be more discreet with the music, to try to, you know, let the scene finish and then come in with the music to kind of support and let you as an spectator emotionally get that scene sink into you, you know, but by the help of the music. But once that the scene is done, you know, so I really dislike when I see, I mean, I could see, picture myself watching a director and an editor in a room looking at a scene that is not working and saying, you know, let's put some music, you know, let's let's see if we can solve this with the music, you know.
Right.
I just don't like that, and I see that a lot.
But also, I was really intrigued to learn that do you always write the music before the film is shot?
I don't, but that's my favorite way of working. I mean,
but that's,
I really,
so
like,
surprising, I think, to an outsider. I mean, one would never imagine that that's even possible.
Well, the biggest example of that is Brokeback. I did the whole score of that movie just from the script. And one meeting with Ang Lee.
Really?
And, before they shot one frame. And obviously, I mean, it was the genius of Ang Lee to say, we're going to put this piece here, we're going to put here this, we're going to repeat it here. But he had, by the moment he sat down to edit the film, he had a basket full of music, you know, that it was inspired by the story, the characters, and by talking to him just once, but, you know, had a great meeting with him. I like to work that way, more in an abstract. And then, obviously, you know, adjust it to a particular scene, or, you know, edit it to the image, or, you know, work, and if you need to extend a part or something. But the themes, the mood of the music of the film, I like to do it that way. And I feel like, for example, Ang will listen to the music during the shooting and play the music to the actors. I know Alejandro González Iñárritu, in some of the hospital scenes in 21 Grams, he played the music on the set because he was going to replace the sound anyhow.
Yeah.
So he could kind of create a mood by playing the music. And so I think the music also becomes kind of a part of the fabric of the film in a different way.
Yes. Rather than an accompaniment, it's part of the fabric.
And yeah, and usually, I mean, I have to say, in the way the industry works is that the musician or the composer comes at the very end when the movie's already edited with some temp music, which is music from other people, from other movies, and then the composer kind of have to, you know, chase that temp. And it's not really very creative, to be honest. I just don't like to work that way. I don't do many films. I'm very, very picky about selecting the films that I get involved with. But I feel very proud of them, and I like the way that I've been able to work in them. Thank you.
I saw online a really interesting conversation that you were part of with John Williams. Mm-hmm. And you brought up the subject of the music in Psycho and in Jaws, which, of course, he did.
Well, he didn't do Psycho. Psycho.
No, Jaws. Right, Jaws.
Yeah, Jaws. Yeah.
And just say a little bit more about what you hear happening in, you know, those two pieces of music, or just to choose one of them, what it is and how that's composed and played, that how that's hooking into the human psyche.
Well, I think, I mean, the element of obsessiveness, the choice of the timbres being, you know, low brass that John used, or the one, you know, that are used in Seku, which are really high strings, you know, by Bernard Herrmann. And something that connects, I think, with a heartbeat in a way. I mean, how when we get anxious, our heartbeat kind of accelerates.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There is a connection with that anxiety. It produces not only tension, but anxiety. I think that's really interesting about those two pieces, that because, you know, tension, there's a lot of pieces that create tension, but these pieces not only create tension, they create a high level of anxiety.
Yeah.
I mean, they mastered it. There's, you know, other pieces in history, but I think those two are, you know, iconic.
To go a little bit deeper with that idea, I feel like from a very early age and all the way through your life with music, you live with a conviction that music has the power to transform people, that it is a transformative medium. And I wonder if you could say, what does music work in us that makes it transformative when it is?
First of all, I think anything that steers your emotions have the potential to transform you.
Yeah.
And I think music has that power, you know, it's something that really, even if it's something that we can't necessarily articulate, there is a process for me of when you are confronted with a work of art and with a great piece of music, of learning something different about the world, about life, about yourself, and I think that transforms you.
Mm-hmm. You often speak of yourself as an artist. Mm-hmm. Not a musician, an artist, mm-hmm. who works with music. And you've also said that art is a way of reorganizing reality.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when you think about the music, the scale, right? It's 12 notes. I mean, it's, you know, the 7 notes with the semitones and stuff. Basically, it's, you know, the way I organize those notes that will be, you know, my melody, and, you know, the way other guy will organize those, it will be his melody, and the way you organize 3 notes, it will be a chord, or 4 notes are a chord. And so, I mean, a painter that decides and interprets a sunset in a particular way, you know, but it's really putting reality in a peculiar way of looking at reality. You know? Mm-hmm. So it's reorganizing it in a very peculiar way. That peculiar way is what gives you the tag, the brand. It's a Picasso, because he has a particular way of reorganizing reality and the vision of reality, his vision of reality, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what is so exciting. And it's something, once again, that transform us and also exercise us. I mean, art has that possibility, you know? So, you know, that's what somebody that's feeling very sad and writes a piece of music, it's a way of exercising that and transforming that, you know, sadness into something now, you know, reorganizing those feelings in a way that now materialize in a piece of music.
Right, that's a form of transformation as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You are more recently working on the soundtrack for a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you about that because, I mean, so when I look this is called The Last of Us. And when I look up the description of it, it says action, adventure, survival, horror video game. Mm-hmm. And it has the caution, blood and gore, intense violence, sexual themes, strong language.
Yeah. It's all of the above. Yeah. Yeah.
And I wonder how you think about, I sense that for you there's a purposefulness in everything you do in your music. And how do you think about the meaning or the transformation that's happening with something like this video game. And granted, I'm giving you the Wikipedia definition of it, and I have not really seen it. So I'm curious about your experience.
Well, the video game, I mean, represented for me to start with a challenge, you know, to do something in a different media that I've never worked before. That was already very attractive to me. I'm not a gamer myself, but I have a 15-year-old son that is a gamer that plays all kinds of games. So I thought that this was fantastic. It's a game, you know, that even if it has some of the elements and the codes that are related to this type of games, it really brought to the table a whole bunch of different things and spaces. And I'm very interested in that, you know, sort of virtual world. And I see it at home, you know, with my son. And you know, how it can be very distracting in a way, but also can be very enjoyable and very useful in a certain sense, because you have to develop certain abilities, como si habilidades, certain skills, you know, that they're interesting, you know, strategies or logistic that, you know, make your brain work in a different way.
Yeah,
as
and
anything
whole,
else, it should be done with moderation, right? If not, you can become a zombie yourself, you know?
That whole genre of, you know, action, adventure, survival, horror is everywhere, especially for these, for new generations. There's something about this.
Probably something that reflects the outside reality.
Yeah.
You know, it's a way to put it together. And it's another way of reorganizing reality.
Yeah, yeah.
We live in a society that is unfortunately full of zombies and horror and you know, awful things. And unfortunately, we just can't go into a console and take care of them.
That's right. This is from Gustavo Santaolalla's score for the popular video game The Last of Us. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. My guest, Gustavo Santaolalla, is best known in the U.S. for his movie soundtracks. He's won 2 Academy Awards for the scores for Babel and Brokeback Mountain. You know, one thing we haven't talked about yet is Motorcycle Diaries, which was about Che Guevara. And, you know, my colleague Lily, who's Colombian, you know, talks about how especially people in Latin America saw that and reacted to that. And just the question about, you know, your own identity, which we talked about in the beginning, as an Argentinian, as a Latin American, as a global citizen, just was that story and was working with music with that story meaningful for you in a special way?
It was very meaningful because I would say that, you know, I come from that generation where, I mean, all those moments were happening at the same time that the Beatles were happening.
Yeah.
Che Guevara was, you know, in full force, you know, so, I mean, lots of things and, you know, and Eastern philosophies were coming. And I mean, I come from that generation. So he's a man that definitely has marked us. The fact also that he's Argentinian, and the fact that he was a guy that until the very end stayed true to his beliefs, and he was a revolutionary. You know, he was a guy that thought that it was necessary to implement the use of weapons to sometimes, you know, get. But what he viewed was a better world. I particularly loved working in Motorcycle Diaries because it tapped into a moment in his life in which he wasn't still Che. He was Ernesto Guevara. He was a guy that became a doctor, you know, and he wanted to really go out and look at the world. I mean, this is a time, you know, in the 50s and stuff, you know, very, very related to, you know, to also people, you know, like Kerouac and people, I mean, that really wanted to go on that road to try to find answers for themselves. It was, you know, it was a self sort of discovery trip. And so that trip that he took with Granado was something that really, I think, kind of shaped and formed the Che to come. You know what I mean? So all those experiences that he lived in those first trips marked him profoundly. I think like when you read when the story of, you know, Siddhartha Gautama, you know, the Buddha, when he finally went out of the palace and went and out to the outside world and looked at what was happening, came back, he was totally transformed. He knew he wanted to do something, you know. And I think of Ernesto the same way, you know. I think that was very important for him to decide what he was going to do and what he was going to devote the rest of his life.
Childhood in Argentina, you traveled a long way musically and geographically. You've gone back. It seems to me that you've always thought about identity. It's kind of been a theme through your life, and also had music as a source of spirit and meaning. And I wonder what have you learned about, you know, what do you know now that you didn't know when you left Argentina at 24? What are some of the insights that have come with time and experience that you might not have guessed then?
Well, I think, I mean, one of obviously transformative experiences to having kids, you know, to have children, and all of my children were born here in the United States. I mean, they're bilingual, and they know, they go to Argentina at least once a year, and they have traveled extensively, so they have that. I tend to also for them to have that global quality, but I think, I mean, that's something definitely that when I came from Argentina didn't know, and that's something that obviously transforms you as a human being, you know. It's the biggest decentralizing factor that you can encounter.
I like that. That's a good way to put it.
In your life is having a kid, you know. So I learned also, because I travel so much around the world, I mean, I kind of been able to support some of my ideas, the ideas, you know, that we talked before, that, you know, how diverse we are and how similar we are, because I've been around the world and I had the opportunity to travel, you know, not in all the world, but, you know, quite a bit of a road. You know, I've been in big places like, you know, China or India or Japan, and, you know, several times, you know, in Africa and, you know, Europe and Greece and Turkey and Israel. I think, I mean, one of the things is reaffirming things that we always knew. I mean, in a way, I think, you know, we everything that we learn is actually, we're relearning it, you know?
Yeah,
something that
something.
We already knew, but now we are confronted with something, and we connect with the knowledge that we already have, and that's part of the process of learning.
Yeah.
So leaving Argentina gave me a lot of that. I mean, I left Argentina in a really bad moment.
You left Argentina right as the dirty war was starting, right?
In the middle of the dirty war.
Right, in the middle, yeah.
So you know, as you know, we have 30,000 people disappeared.
Yeah.
And it was really horrible, and we're still suffering from that. I mean, we're still, fortunately, in the last 10 years, you know, most of the people that have been involved in those heinous crimes have been brought to justice and put in jail, a lot of them, you know, which didn't happen before, because they had amnesties and all these awful, you know, things that just, you know, to get away with it. But now most of them are in jail, but we still, you know, feel the repercussions of what happened. I mean, we have organizations like, you know, Madres de Plaza de Mayo, and we have Abuelas de Plaza de Mayo, which actually Abuelas is an organization that is trying to identify and find, you know, grandkids of people that were disappeared.
Right, right.
We know we have 500 of them, and we only have recouped like around 120 now.
Yeah.
Meaning recoup is, you know, precisely, that's how they call it, finding their identity, finding who their parents were and you know, what happened to them. And that's basically, you know, in some cases, some of those kids have been raised by nice families, and in some cases have been raised by the same people that actually killed their parents.
Yeah.
So it's really, so So in that context, you know, I came from Argentina to look at the world and realize, you know, why also these things happen and how injustice, you know, goes rampant around the world and what can I do to make a difference and how can the work that you do affect people and transform people, like what we were talking before. I think it is very important. And with all the other thing that also I learned, and I think time was very helpful, is how to deal with, you know, these great recognitions that you can get through, you know, through your career, you know?
Right.
And how can you put that in context, you know, and realize that actually, you know, the awards are never giving to you as a person. They're giving to your work to start with.
And you're internalizing that distinction.
Yes, and your work is not only the fruit of your job. So that's one. And the other one is that usually when you are there in the podium, you know, getting an award and stuff, that's also the culmination of a phase or work that involved other people, not only yourself.
Right, right.
So, you know, I mean, I think all those things I learned with time and age.
Yeah. So let me just ask you this big question. In some ways, we've been talking about this the whole time, but this life you've lived, you know, where you were born, where you've gone, and your life in music, you know, how do you think that's formed your sense of what it means to be human? How do you think about that question?
I felt, you know, that I haven't, you know, it's a funny thing because I felt that I had control of my life and I do have control of my life, but at the same time, I'm very aware that I don't, you know. I think this is something that happens to everybody, you know, but I've been also proved so many times that something else was, you know, coincidence, says whatever it is, but situations that actually I didn't have anything to, or something to do, but not really any logistics behind, you know, the way I came into making music for movies, for example. You know, I've always been told that my music was very visual, but, you know, my first coming really to some type of recognition was because I did the music for Amores Perros, you know? And I almost didn't do that music because I was so busy making records at the time and I never saw a script, I never saw a rough cut, and it was Alejandro's first time director. And I was so busy, I said, you know, tomorrow called and say, please, I'm not going to be able to do this. And in the middle of the night, right, I woke up and I started thinking, what if this guy's a genius? You know, and I'm not. So that's how that happened. He turned me into Walter Salles. And one thing, I mean, all life, and suddenly, you know, I was doing Motorcycle Diaries, and suddenly when we present Motorcycle Diaries in Sundance, I was doing Brokeback Mountain. And I remember the first time I was nominated for a Grammy, I lost. And I thought, this is it. This is my career. This was my big opportunity, you know, and I missed it. And then, you know, life proved me differently. And so I'm very, in a way, I mean, I try to control what I do, but at the same time, I like to dance with whatever rhythm life proposes to me.
Okay. Gustavo Santaolalla has composed film scores for over a dozen features, including Amores Perros, The Motorcycle Diaries, Brokeback Mountain, Babel, On the Road, and Wild Tales. His latest solo album is called Camino. You can listen again or share this episode at onbeing.org. There, you can also sign up for our weekly email newsletter. From Courtney Martin on the silver lining in severed friendship to Sharon Salzberg on the real power of generosity, each week a nourishing dive into all that's happening in our online and social media spaces. To subscribe, just click newsletter on any page at onbeing.org. Thank you. On Being is Trent Gilliss, Chris Heagle, Lily Percy, Mariah Helgeson, Nikki Oster, Michelle Keeley, and Selena Carlson. Our major funding partners are the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Fetzer Institute, fostering awareness of the power of love and forgiveness to transform our world. Find them at fetzer.org. Calliopeia Foundation, contributing to organizations that weave reverence, reciprocity, and resilience into the fabric of modern life. And the Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. Our corporate sponsor is Mutual of America. Since 1945, Americans have turned to Mutual of America to help plan for their retirement and meet their long-term financial objectives. Mutual of America is committed to providing quality products and services to help you build and preserve assets for a financially secure future.
On Being is distributed by American Public Media and is a Krista Tippett Public production.